You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rock Art Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and this is episode 157. We are very blessed and very honored to have a couple of remarkable scholars with us today. And they are Maria Guagnin, Dr. Carrie Shipton. Maria is a researcher at the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology, and her work focuses on prehistoric settlement, rock art, environmental change in North Arabian Sahara, and she integrates field archaeology, archaeozoology, and digital survey techniques to help her interpret human-environmental interactions during the Holocene. And with Carrie, he's the senior lecturer in archaeology at the Australian National University, investigating human behavioral evolution, particularly across Africa and Asia. His research explores technological innovation, mobility, and adaptation through the Pleistocene-Holocene transitions. And they've been working together to try to deal with some of the challenging questions about changing climates, landscapes, and symbolic expression shaping early human societies. So, Maria and Carrie, are you with us?
Yes, we are.
Yes, here. Yeah.
Fantastic. So, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourselves and maybe talk a bit about how you ever got involved with archaeology in general, and specifically the study of rock art, paleo environment, whatever people that listen to this particular podcast understand. We take a very broad brush to that topic. I talk about paleo religion. We also talk about prehistoric socio-political organization and all things rock art, especially, as you were saying, some symbolic expressions and trying to understand or try to grapple with the imagery and what it might have meant or could mean to us today.
Yes, I ended up with rock art and environment, what mostly accidentally, really. I worked on a project in the Sahara many years ago with Tarja Barnett, and that's led to a PhD looking at the rock art and just the sheer nature of the animal species that you can see in it led to sort of me looking at environmental changes. And then after my PhD shifted to Arabia, to the Paleo Deserts Project, where I met Carrie and we started doing field work in Arabia and looking at the rock art of Arabia.
And I started working in Arabia with Mike Petraglia looking for early Homo sapiens, middle Paleolithic sites, sort of 75,000 years old. And we were working in this area called Juba. And while we were looking for these middle Paleolithic archaeology, we kept seeing these beautiful rock engravings. And so, yeah, we became really interested in these as something of a much later period in time. And then that's when Maria came on to the project.
So it sounds remarkable. So it was a series of almost a coincidence in which you both connected. Tell us a little bit about the recent efforts that resulted in that remarkable article that I alluded to, in terms of understanding this potential hiatus in human land use patterns.
Yes, so we were working in Juba together, and we wanted to sort of see the wider landscape. And one afternoon, we took a recce with our Saudi colleagues that involved some very adventurous driving. And we drove quite far, and in the late afternoon, we found this really fantastic rock art site with very large camel engravings. And it was very hot and we were very tired, but there were some lithics on the ground and it was decided to dig a little test trench. And then we found a lot more than we thought we would. And also when we sent the samples to the radiocarbon lab, everything turned out a lot older than we thought it would be. And so Carrie and I thought, well, actually, we need to look at this a bit closer. We need to apply for some funding to go back out and revisit the site and a few others in that area to see whether we can find more and whether that can help us date the rock art.
What did you find at that initial discovery that really hooked you into this research theme?
Well, from a rock art perspective, it's a fantastic site that has these really big sort of pillar boulders with cracks in them. And in the cracks, there are these really large engravings of large camels. One of them is a whole family with a mother camel, father camel, and baby. And then nearby, a few hundred meters further north, is another panel that is in low relief. So they're really spectacular images. And also, it was one of the few times that we found a lot of lithics.
And the lithics that came out of this test trench. There was one in particular that was this really unusual, distinctive type that I've never seen before with this type of retouch called Hell One, this sort of invasive backing retouch, if your listeners know something about lithic technology. But that is a specific type known from the Pleistocene-Holocene transition in the Levant. So this really made us think that we had genuine archaeology of that age and also perhaps some long-distance connections as well.
What was the age of that initial discovery?
I think it was about 13,600 BC, something around, not BC, BP.
BP.
Yeah.
BP. Yeah. And that was in this window of time that heretofore scholars, rock art scholars, anthropologists, archaeologists, believe there was a considerable hiatus in human use of this area, correct?
Yes. So we have Middle Paleolithic occupation going down to about maybe 60,000, 65,000. And then there's nothing really until you get to the Holocene Humid period, or we previously believed that. The Holocene Humid period is this period from about 8,000 to 5,000 years ago, when Arabia was much wetter than it is at present. And then there is, at least in the sort of second half of that period, there's a lot of evidence for human occupation. But before that, there's just this big gap in the record when Arabia seems to have been hyper-arid.
Amazing. That's really very interesting. What were the steps involved in trying to deal with this rather enormous problem, this research theme that you had? What did you have to do to sort of wrap your mind around this and deal with some of the many aspects of this problem?
Yeah, so I think one of the key issues we had to start with is how do we link this to the rock art? And this place where we had the test excavation, the trench was not exactly underneath the panel. It was, five meters, 10 meters away from it. And the trench was quite complex. But then we had heard of two panels nearby, and we thought, let's visit those. And then when we went to see them, we actually realized they were connected to whole landscapes of rock art and to more lithics. And so that's where we got lucky at a place called Jebel Anan, where actually the lithics were directly underneath the panel, including one of the engraving tools. And so slowly we were able to piece together the archaeology and the rock art. And that then helped us to go back to the first site and say, actually, now that we know this is how it links, that we can interpret this trench better.
So was it because it was a single component rock art site that had the rock art images and the archaeology in intimate association?
Yes, so that's sort of one of the key things. If you only have rock art from one period, then it helps with the archaeology that's nearby. And that's actually quite rare. Often there's like a palimpsest across lots of different phases, and that makes it harder to link. So yes, in these locations, we only had this very ancient rock art.
Yeah. I think we got really lucky with this Jebel Anan.
Yeah, it's very fortunate. That's a rather rare circumstance. I was impressed by the nature of this imagery. You alluded to that they were sometimes life-size images of these animals. Am I correct?
Yes. Yeah, they're absolutely massive. They are the size of an actual camel, really. And
wow.
They are. Some of them are more than 2 meters long. Yeah.
Now, besides the animal subject matter, there were other elements, other images that were there on these rocks as well. Were there not?
It was mostly animal images. So we have camel and we have a lot of wild equids. So we don't know whether these are African wild ass or onager, because in the rock art, in the outline, that would look fairly similar. We have gazelles and we have ibex. And we also have one wild cattle or ox.
Now, you had images of people?
Yes, so we can tell that underneath there are even earlier images, and they are of people. And there's two phases
really?
We can see. Yes. So there's one early phase that has these women with sort of very pronounced curves. So they're really beautiful. And then we also have large human figures that have sort of in very simple outlines that we found.
So there are women figures that are more ancient than even the imagery of the animals that you've alluded to. Any idea how old they could be, either minimum age or anything like that?
Well, we are now sort of trying to link them to the this oldest archaeology that we found in this
Right.
that Carrie mentioned with the tool, with the Helwan retouch. And so because we now know that the engraving tool that was used to make the camels was bracketed by OSL dates to around 12,000 years ago, we then conclude that the other images must be older and
must be
linked to these earlier radiocarbon dates that we've been getting.
Do you think that these human images could be supramundane beings, deities or shamans? And would those be correlated or the same age? Would they be doing hunting? Would these be hunters and gatherers, foragers at that time?
It would have been hunter-gatherers, foragers, and I mean, they just look like very beautiful women. So I'm not really sure whether they were spiritual beings or not. They look, we've previously known of similar figures like that, but didn't know what time period they may come from. They often have sort of braided hair. Sometimes they have garments or belts. So they can be quite detailed.
Skirts.
Cross skirts, okay. Yes. Interesting. Then there's no ethnographic analogs, obviously. You're talking about thousands of years, correct?
Yes, yeah. There's no parallels that we can draw on.
Yeah. So how do you go about interpreting or dealing with the element of interpretation with these sites, given the lack of ethnographic material?
Well, my assumption is always that there is clearly a symbolic element in there, that a lot of that we can't decipher. And so I'm sticking to what we can decipher and then sort of moving towards other elements that we can see in there.
So going from the known to the unknown, correct?
Yes, exactly. Because, yes. I mean, they are representations of things that these people were familiar with, that they
Right.
saw in their environment, whether that is the women, so they had a particular way of dressing or wearing their hair, which is reflected. And with these animals, they were clearly very familiar with them because they have a lot of detail. There's the hair and skin folds and sinews and nostrils, and, you know, they really knew.
Very natural and realistic. They're in no way abstract, correct?
Yeah, no, they are extremely naturalistic. And these earliest camels, it almost looks like they show individuals, you know, with
Wow.
their lumps and bumps and the way that particular animal looked.
Well, let's break it off there and we'll pick it up on the next segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang, to the Rock Art Podcast. We're in the second segment of episode 157. And we're talking to a couple of remarkable scholars who have done tremendous research in rock art, but also in the association of rock art with environment of archaeology and the interrelationships between those areas, which are not well known. Have you faced that at all, Maria or Carrie, in terms of trying to deal with the integration of paleo-environmental data, archaeology, the dating issue, the hard archaeology, and then relating that to the symbolism that we have with rock art? That's something that's, to articulate those data sets, is not so easy.
Yes, that is hard, obviously, because first of all, you need to know the date to be able to link it to the environment and the archaeology. And as we all know, in rock art, that's always the challenging bit, which is where Carrie and I got extremely lucky with this Jebel Anan site, because not only did we have the actual engraving tool in a datable archaeological context telling us it's about 12,000 years old, we worked with a team that studies the paleoenvironment that had come to join us in the field season, and they looked at paleo lakes nearby, near these rock art sites that we were finding, and they were dating the paleo lakes, and they came back of a similar age as the rock art. And so we actually ended up having this two-pronged approach, which was really unique, I think.
Tell us a bit about paleo lakes and about what the environment was like when the images were being fashioned. What is a paleo lake, and what kind of environment were these foragers, these hunter-gatherers, dealing with?
So this is actually quite tricky because this is really the first data that we have of this period. So we know that in the Holocene humid period, which is linked to the Neolithic and is a few thousand years later, that there was more rainfall in Arabia and there was more lakes and more vegetation, and that enabled cattle herding. But we're in a period before that is sort of much more desert-like. And we know that at the end of the Ice Age, the last glacial maximum was extremely arid. And all of these deserts, the Sahara as well as Arabia, they expanded, they became really inhospitable. And so when the period that we find this rock art in is really the first period once this hyper-aridity has ended and we're returning to normal desert conditions. And these, when there is rainfall, the water pools in sort of surface lakes, shallow lakes, really like large puddles. And when that evaporates, they leave these sediments behind. And then when that happens every year, you get a whole accumulation of sediment. And that is basically what our colleagues dug through and dated. And so they could really date when this sediment from these surface water collections started accumulating. And that luckily coincided with the rock art.
Do the paleo-environmental people agree with sort of the animal, the faunal inventory that is seen in the rock art imagery as being possible and probable in terms of co-occurring with the mesic environment they're talking about?
Yes. So from what they can tell from the sediment is that there's not a lot of signs of vegetation. There's no organic remains. And
okay.
So their interpretation was that this was still a desert landscape. It wasn't that vegetation was well established or anything like that. So fairly arid still. And this is what we see in the rock art. So we see wild camel, we see ibex, we see gazelles. So we see this really typical desert fauna.
Right. Extremely arid environments, correct?
Yes, with the one exception of the one engraving of a wild cattle that we have, because
yes,
they are obligate drinkers. And so that is the curveball so far. What is that one doing in that region?
Right.
Is that an exceptionally wet period? Or did these people travel to somewhere that had more water during maybe the dry season and then came back and recorded that image? That's something we don't know yet.
And I think one of the really interesting things about the paleo-environmental evidence is, as Maria is saying, there's not much organic evidence from these lake deposits. And so the environmental team concluded these were ephemeral lakes, probably seasonal. And then in the rock art with the camel images, that also looks to have an element of seasonality to it, because they depict male camels in rut with these big throat sacs that they have to make this sort of mating call.
No, that's fascinating. That's really very interesting that they would actually have a gender on the animals and be able to talk about the seasonality. So you said there was the time when these camels were in a rut period, correct?
Yes. So the problem is that the wild camels are extinct. And
yep,
the only studies that we have are of feral camels in, mostly the Sahara, really.
Right.
And these studies have shown that camels always time their mating season with the wet phase locally.
Sure.
And so if you move the camel to a different area where the wet phase is at a different time, apparently they change their mating season to coincide again with the rains. And so it's quite interesting that they specifically show the mating season in these male camels. They all have this like really bulging neckline in the engravings.
And what is that from physiologically? Why do they have that bulge? Do we know?
So male camels, they have a soft palate piece that they inflate that hangs out of their mouth. It's called a dula. It's not a pretty looking thing.
No, it's not a pretty looking thing.
It's absolutely disgusting watching
it's
them.
Really
okay. But it's amazing.
Yeah, but the dula itself is not shown in the rock art. But in order to inflate that, they strain their neck muscles. So they inflate like a lot of air into their neck. And
okay,
at the same time, they make this rumbling noise. And all of that together really makes the neck bulge. And I think often when you hear camels making these noises, you can see their inflated neck. So I think the dula extending is actually a very small percentage of time that happens. Most of the time, you get the sort of bulging neckline sort of in the build up to that. And that's somehow what they chose to show in all of the rock art.
And that's either some attraction to a female, is it? Or something like that? No?
That is the interpretation, that the females are attracted to this, yes.
Okay. And then, interesting. And that would be the time that they'd be attracted by the water, because there'd be aggregation events and, you know, situations where they could get together. Fascinating. So, and camels, as you said, make up the vast abundance, the lion's share of this imagery, correct?
Yes, yeah, most of them are camels. I can't remember what proportion, but I would say it's probably more than 80% is camels in that period. So now, clearly a fascination with this animal. And I wonder whether this sort of is not just about the mating season and the wet phase, but maybe even, I mean, my association would be, you know, if you imagine these hunter-gatherers living in this desert environment, there might have also been some fascination with the camel's ability to survive in these areas.
Exactly. And it might have something to do with reproduction, fertility, you know, revitalization, yes, seasonality, all of that and much more. You said there were ibex also represented.
Yes.
Now, were they distinctively represented in any way? Was there any sort of, you know, canon for the way that the ibex was rendered or no?
Yes, they're all male, shown with these really beautiful big horns.
Really?
But that
really?
Is not just in that period, like throughout all 12,000 years of rock art production in Arabia, it's always a focus on the male ibex, and presumably because they have these big horns.
Fascinating. Very amazing. So tell me a bit more about your adventure in trying to get these sites documented. It must have been very challenging. You're out in an area that's very dry and there's no resources. Was it very challenging to even conduct research in these areas?
We work with the Saudi Heritage Commission, and some of their staff are fantastic drivers, and they've grown up, you know, driving over rocks and sand dunes.
Yeah.
And that's been really helpful because Lanan was quite involved off-roading to even get to that location.
Right.
And we knew about the one panel that somebody had reported, and there was the actual site itself we could see had been damaged. An enthusiast had dug up the sediment because the sediment had partly covered the camel engraving, and somebody had dug that up to reveal the legs of the camel, and in that process had destroyed the ancient archaeological site, luckily leaving enough sediment undisturbed, so we were able to find the engraving tool and date it. And then we looked around to see whether there's more lithics on the ground and whether there was more rock art. And one of the Saudi colleagues went, it was in an embayment, and at the back there was a boulder, and he just climbed behind that boulder. And then he realized this wasn't like a closed off embayment. There was actually a little passageway leading off up the mountain from there. And as you go up, it leads to a water hole, you know, one of those deep crevices in the rock where water pools for long periods. And the whole, all of the rock surface around it were completely covered in more of this rock art. And really the whole gully all the way up the mountain was flanked by these really big rock art panels on either side. And then we looked at the satellite image and discovered that actually this is a shortcut across the mountain. And on the other side is a paleo lake. So it was really connecting the lake and the water hole. And it was marking the passage with...
So it's certainly a study in landscape archaeology.
Absolutely, but it did involve a lot of climbing.
a lot of climbing and a lot of good fortune and a lot of creativity.
Tell the story of the Jebel Mizmah discovery.
Please.
So this other site, Jebel Mizmah, we'd been there before and seen that there was individual camels on isolated boulders at the base of this Jebel. This big mountain. And we went back to excavate underneath one of these boulders. And behind on the cliff, there was this huge cliff face with these beautiful vertical rock faces. And we looked at it and were like, oh, it's a shame they never do those engravings high up, because that would be absolutely perfect. And we were there digging away on the first morning working at this site. And one of our labourer who was helping us, a Sudanese guy called Idris Saleh, had a really good eye for spotting the lithics in the sieve. And he kept pointing up at the cliff face and saying, Jamal. And I was like, no, there's nothing up there. We've looked there already. There's no Jamals on that cliff. But he was very insistent. So I had a second look. And just as the light was, this would have been
lo
about
and behold, there they were.
10 in the morning, just as the light was coming round the rock face, the oblique angle suddenly just picked out, the cliff face was completely covered in these life-size camels, like a whole herd of a dozen,
really,
more than a dozen.
Yeah, that really something that only rock art people know about, because you can't see anything at certain times of day if it's too bright or if or if it's rained, they're gone.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it was just visible for these about 2 hours after that. And then in the afternoon sun, you couldn't see them at all again.
And that word, yeah, and that word, does that word mean camels? Jamal?
That word is the Arabic for camel.
I love it. Well, let's close this one down and pick you up on the flip-flop. Hey, out there in podcast land, this is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, with Maria and Carrie. And we're talking about their research that they've done in some of the driest places on Earth. And how rock art and environmental studies and also an understanding of prehistory and archaeology all blend together. So, Carrie and Maria, take it away.
Yeah, one of the sort of the most striking things to me about this rock art is its scale. But as we've been saying, these camels are life size and there are dozens of them. And the entire body has been engraved. So it must have taken a lot of effort to do. And on this cliff face I was talking about in Jebel Mizmeh, it must have been very risky as well, because the ledge at which they're, the ledges which they're standing on, less than a meter wide. So yeah, I think there's a real sort of conspicuous effort that's gone into this art, and that's the really striking thing about it for me. And I suppose the model I have in my head, linking back to the seasonality in the camels and the lakes, is that these are perhaps sort of seasonal gatherings of people coming together when it's the wet time, when the landscape can support bigger groups of people. And I think we kind of have some evidence to support that from the archaeology, because at Jebel Arnan, we have obsidian, which has been brought from around 200 kilometers to the south from a volcano called Kaibar and a volcanic region called Kaibar. And we also have marine shell beads, and the nearest sea is over 300 kilometers away. So we've got material being brought in from a long way to these sites, perhaps as part of some sort of seasonal get together during which this rock art is created.
Maria, what do you think about all this? What's the most important thing that our listeners should take away from your spectacular amount of research and the way it was done and some of the major contributions that are being made to our understanding of prehistory?
Yeah, I think I agree with Carrie. To me, one of the elements is a scale, and it's really hard to even bring this across in publications, how big they are and how much they would have marked the landscape. And as in a lot of desert environments, you end up with this black varnish on the rocks. So when these were freshly engraved, they would have been like these big sand-colored camels on the black rock surface. So they must have been extremely striking and really visible across vast distances. And for me, the second element is this sort of this practical aspect that we really started exploring this time. How did they even get to these various locations where they engraved? For example, at Jebel Mizmeh, climbing up 39 meters above the ground, hanging onto a narrow ledge while engraving. And the fact that we were, you know, finding engraving tools. And for a long time, I didn't even know what an engraving tool looked like. It wasn't until I worked with a stonemason at the camel site a few years previously, who picked up a few, you know, rock tools and went, oh, you know, I could engrave something with that. And I thought, wow, I imagine something a lot more sophisticated. When actually a lot of the time, these are just sort of angular rocks that they brought from somewhere that has sort of slightly harder rock, and then use that to engrave the sandstone until it looks like a beautiful camel.
You had hypothesized the reason or purpose or function of these images. Why don't you say a few things about that?
Yes, so the way they are distributed in the landscape seems to suggest that this is when people come together at specific times of the year when there's water around. We know from sites that have large camels, like the camel site, that they spend a lot of time engraving them. So the whole community must have somehow worked together in, you know, bringing the raw materials for the tools, in supporting those that engraved. At Jebel Mizmeh, we know they could climb up. They must have spent a lot of time up there engraving. But we also have panels where they must have used some sort of rigging system to keep the engravers up while they were doing their task. And so there is clearly an element of communal effort involved in these ancient engravings. that we don't quite see in the later engravings. So the sheer scale of it required multiple people to work together to make them happen.
You mentioned in the article that I read something about these being possible signs or demarcations for others to know where the water sources are. Is that still something yes. viable?
Please. Absolutely. So in Jebel Anan, the rock art marks the path to the water source. So they stretch along a long gully
really?
That goes up the mountain. and as you walk along that path, it's a shortcut across the mountain that leads you to a waterhole and then to an ephemeral lake. And your path is flanked by these life-sized camels on each side and by some wild equids. And in Jebel Misma, this big panel, the big panel is high up, and then along the base, there's a lot of sort of smaller, individual panels with only one or two life-sized camels. So none of this is small, really. And it's right by an ancient lake. So it would have, again, been a small embayment looking over this lake. And the way to climb up to this high panel is actually via a waterhole. So you climb up maybe 2 or 3 meters, and you get to like a big dip in the rock that collects the water. And then from there, it's really steep. And they've even carved footholds into the rock to give access to these higher panels. So a lot of planning and logistics went into making this rock art.
Absolutely. What did any of the native indigenous people that are familiar with this country think about your effort? Did they go along with you and help you to get through this country? And what were their thoughts?
Yes, I mean, they are absolutely fascinated because they love the fact that it's camels in the rock art and the fact that they mark water sources, you know, because the water is so special for any people living in the desert. And so that obviously captures people's imaginations immediately.
Did they assist you in any way in terms of locating sites or getting to the sites or having information about potential discoveries?
Yes, yeah. So they help us survey and they help us get to the actual location. So some of the Saudi colleagues are drivers and some of the Saudi colleagues are trained archaeologists.
Really?
And you know, they were really excited finding these panels. They were like gazelles climbing up the mountains. And sometimes it was a little bit worrying because it's quite precarious and high up. And I wanted to make sure everyone comes back uninjured.
Yeah.
And I had to call them back a few times to say, please don't go.
But they're probably more used to this country than anyone else would be.
But I think also everyone got a bit carried away with excitement, and I didn't want anyone to fall
or have problems. Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, very interesting, remarkable experiences. I'm rather envious, and it's very interesting. We in America, I think, rarely find the percussors, the actual tools that are used to produce the rock images. I know occasionally, but very rarely, do we find those. I think they were using tools, stones that were made of this white quartz, which was rather good on the basalt. I know that my colleague has done some XRF on some of these sites that are made of desert varnish and has been doing some direct dating of those. It would be interesting to see if any of that would be helpful to you or not. I don't know if his instrument or if his ability goes back over 10,000 years, though.
Yes, Meinrad Andrea?
I published with him, please. Yeah.
Yes, he's lovely. I have worked with him on rock art sites in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah.
But there is a maximum age where the erosion outstrips the varnish buildup. And so that's really the problem. So up until the Neolithic, he can date them and it works. It's really amazing because it works like OSL dating. So for rock art, I mean, that is really an incredible resolution. But these large camels, they're really beyond the method.
They're beyond the angle.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of them are eroded to a degree that often the varnish and the whole rock surface is really degraded.
And so the only way you can see them is with the glancing light Carrie had said,
but yes,
you really need that. You really need a special way of photographing them as well. I guess if you could use some of that light that glances off of it and then cover it in terms of having, you know, get the sun off of it. I know I have had that same problem with some of these very light scratching that's done in the late prehistoric and historic times by women called Numic Scratched. You can't see them. You absolutely cannot see them. And it looked like to me from the photographs and the information that I read that this material is of the same, you know, tapestry. Am I correct?
So the engravings themselves are quite deep, but because they are so eroded, often you can only see them in optimal light conditions. So the big panel that was discovered by the laborer, what we ended up doing is having to come back in optimal light conditions and fly a drone to record it because it was so high up. Because ideally what I'd love to do is do some night photography, but because a lot of them are in high up location, there is absolutely no way you can get up there with a light. So we had to wait for the sun to be in the perfect angle and then use a drone.
Yeah, that's hard. Well, I think that's it for us. This was a remarkable conversation, and I'm honored and blessed to have Maria and Carrie with me and to talk about their work. And thank you so much, Maria and Carrie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you on the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.